From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at the week in news, politics, and more. Coming up,
with just over 2 weeks until Arkansas votes in the presidential contests, a look at what influence New Hampshire could have here.
We'll also talk with representatives of the Arkansas campaigns for the two Democratic presidential candidates.
The state surgeon general makes the case at the winter meeting of the County Judges Association that Medicaid expansion will free up their budgets.
An alleged assault on Arkansas Treasurer Dennis Milligan, while there's a request for a review of ethics complaints against him.
The nation's high court temporarily halts a rule limiting carbon emissions at power plants. Arkansas officials evaluate their steps.
A plan to scale back bonus pay for Arkansas teachers is withdrawn amid pressure. We'll look at why.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
For the week ending Friday, February 12th, 2016, this is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Early voting begins this coming week in Arkansas, ahead of the state's March 1st election. The key race, of course, is that for president. And Chris, this week in New Hampshire, that was the second state to weigh in, and we had a different set of candidates come out on top. Donald Trump won on the Republican side, and Bernie Sanders won on the Democratic side. You spoke with one political scientist about what impact this could have in the state, and of course we also now have two less candidates on the Republican side.
Yeah, Carly Fiorina and Governor Chris Christie dropped out. Well, what's different about New Hampshire is that, you know, of course, we had different results in the Iowa caucuses. You know, Senator Ted Cruz won with Donald Trump coming in second, Marco Rubio a close third, and on the Democratic side, there's a even split pretty much between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And what we saw after Iowa was that, you know, Mike Huckabee, our former governor, dropped out of the presidential race. He had a pretty poor performance. And a lot of Arkansas Republicans who had endorsed Huckabee, many of them switched their endorsements over to Marco Rubio, who's seen as like one of the leading establishment candidates, quote unquote, since Trump and Cruz tend to be viewed with skepticism and seen as outsiders, quote unquote. Rubio had placed a strong third in Iowa, but in New Hampshire, he didn't do quite as well. I spoke with Greg Shufelt, a political science professor at UALR, about how Rubio's placing in New Hampshire might impact his support in Arkansas, particularly among some of the elected office holders in the state Republican Party, and here's what he had to say.
I think if Senator Rubio would have had another strong night tonight, we would have seen more Republicans, including Arkansas Republicans, make a move to supporting him as sort of the anti-Trump or anti-Cruz candidate. But because of his showing tonight, we might see elected officials like our own Governor Asa Hutchinson hold off for a little bit before they make an endorsement. And as long as the Republican Party or the elites within the Republican Party refrain from making an endorsement between quote-unquote establishment candidates like Kasich, Bush, or Rubio, or Christie, that's better news for candidates like Trump and Cruz.
And as we saw earlier this week, was it this week that the Talk Business Hendricks College poll
came out on Sunday
and showed that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump kind of led the field on the Republican side with Rubio kind of a close second, each splitting about a third of the vote, more or less. Shufelt was adamant about the line of thought that the middling performances by these so-called establishment Republicans like Jeb Bush, Rubio, and Kasich. Kasich actually did very well in New Hampshire, placed second, but this kind of played into Shufelt's observation that by placing strongly in New Hampshire, Kasich actually kind of really still puts a kind of shroud of uncertainty over that kind of establishment support for that establishment group. And he really felt that Kasich's strong placing still emboldens Trump and Cruz here in Arkansas.
As long as the Republican field stays a deep bench of former senators and governors, that's better news for candidates like Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. If we see some sort of coordination between South Carolina and Nevada before we get to Arkansas and other southern states, and candidates like Christie, but Bush or Kasich or Rubio decide to drop out between now and then, and there's more of a consolidation of the establishment vote, then one of those candidates might be poised to do well in a state like Arkansas. But if Rubio, Bush, and Kasich are still in the race competing with Trump and Cruz, it's hard to see a path where the more conservative candidates don't win the party's nomination here in the state.
So that's his assessment on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, as we know, Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton. And Shufelt noted that Sanders really benefited from, you know, a certain demographic of voters who turned out in New Hampshire.
Senator Sanders is going to do well in states that have demographics that are similar to New Hampshire, that have high levels of college-educated citizens, that have large numbers of white Democratic primary voters, that have large numbers of white liberal voters and younger primary voters. And that's not necessarily Arkansas's electoral population. So because of her deep roots and because of the groups that even in the New Hampshire exit polls are showing, where Secretary Clinton is doing best are closer to the demographics of a state like Arkansas.
You know, Shufelt noted that, you know, along with a lot of other political pundits have noted this, that, you know, Hillary gets a lot of the support of older Democrats, largely the support from African-American voters. And so he still feels that Senator Sanders will have not as strong of a chance winning Arkansas. And also given that, you know, Hillary has, as he said, deep roots here, being the former first lady. And
I guess I've got a few endorsement roundups there if we want to talk about this a little bit longer. And it's kind of debatable, and people debate about this all the time, how much endorsements really matter. You know, do they really influence the electorate, or are they more just a signal of where the electorate is? But for what it's worth, with Governor Christie and Carly Fiorina dropping out, they didn't have much support in Arkansas, but they did have a few legislators. There's one for Christie, three for Carly Fiorina. None of them have announced what they're going to do so far at this point, but Grant Hodges, who is the youngest legislator in the state, he said on Tuesday to expect another round of endorsements from legislators. He wouldn't say who for, but we might find out a little bit next week. Still, and with Mike Huckabee dropping out, you mentioned that a lot of the support had gone to Rubio, including Representatives Womack and Crawford and Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin. Still outstanding in that equation is Governor Asa Hutchinson, French Hill, the U.S. Representative for Central Arkansas, and U.S. Senator John Bozeman. We don't know how they'll lie exactly at this point. I think Kasich also had about one supporter, and of course Sanders has zero state legislators supporting him. Everyone on the Democratic side is going in for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and we saw kind of an indicator of Arkansas now coming into focus from the national campaign as Hillary Clinton opened up an Arkansas state campaign office. And somewhat telling, it only comes 3 weeks before the election day, whereas Senator Sanders has actually had a few offices open around the state. But on Monday, I spoke with representatives of both state campaigns. And on the Hillary's campaign, Grant Tenniel spoke on her behalf. He, of course, the former director of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, and pretty much said that we shouldn't be reading too much into the fact that they waited until now to open his campaign. And here's a little bit of my conversation with him on Monday.
Obviously, as always, there is a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary here in Arkansas. And we're gearing up because, you know, we've always known that this was going to be a competitive race and that we'd have to fight for every vote. And we're not taking a single thing for granted, not even the support of Arkansans who have known her probably longest and best.
Yeah, I was going to ask why it's come down, you know, here 3 weeks before the election. I think Bernie Sanders has had an office open for a few months. Why has it taken a while to, you know, so close to the election to open the office?
Well, I think really it's been more about focusing the resources appropriately and where they're needed. And, you know, there has been a whole lot of activity, obviously, in Iowa and New Hampshire. And as the race moves Nevada and then south, the campaign is gearing up to make its case to the people of this region.
Are there any specific differences in Arkansas compared to the other states, especially Iowa's voted New Hampshire coming up? But anything different about how the campaign will handle things in Arkansas compared to elsewhere?
No, I think that what you'll see are more events and canvassing as people here realize, again, as you said, 3 weeks out, the election is getting closer. And the Clinton team is going to work hard to make sure that Arkansas firmly remains Clinton country.
Well, we had new poll come out yesterday from Talk Business and Politics and Hendricks College, which found Hillary Clinton with a safe lead in Arkansas, 57% compared to 25% for Bernie Sanders. But 18% say they don't know, and that's kind of a sizable group there. What are y'all going to do to try to win the support of people who at this point say they're not sure?
Well, I think that's why you open a campaign office. That's why you don't take anything for granted. And that's why you get out and work hard and make a forceful argument that she is the right leader for Arkansas and for the country. She's going to fight for progress because she's a progressive who actually likes to make progress. And the race is going to come down to, clearly, who gets out, who works hardest. And it would be unwise for anyone to assume that she's not going to work hard and fight and contest every single race. And Arkansas is no exception.
And finally, Grant, any particular strategy or how are y'all going to get out? Are these going to be events or are people going to be going door to door? How are y'all going to be campaigning?
I think you've just hit upon the two things that you'll see more and more of in the coming weeks. There will be events and lots of door-to-door canvassing because, again, the important thing here is to make sure that everyone understands that Secretary Clinton is going to work hard to keep the support of Arkansans.
All right, that's Grant Tenniel, the former head of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, now part of the Hillary Clinton Arkansas campaign team. Grant, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
And 1 hour after I did that interview Monday afternoon, then spoke with the Arkansas State Director for Bernie Sanders' campaign, Sarah Scanlon.
We actually have groups all over the state that are doing phoning. We're talking to Arkansans all over the state to find out where they are on the presidential campaign, on the presidential race. And we're doing a lot of door-to-door activity starting up this week. And then we have weekly meetings with all of our groups. So a lot of activity.
We had a poll that came out yesterday from Talk Business and Hendricks College showed at this point Hillary Clinton with 57% support, 25% for Bernie Sanders, but 18% say they don't know. That's a pretty sizable chunk. What are y'all doing to really try and sway people who maybe are on the fence, aren't sure yet who they're going to vote for?
So the best way to actually reach people is in their own homes. And we're having personal conversations. We're talking about, our volunteers are actually talking about why it is that they're supporting Senator Sanders and why they think that Senator Sanders is the best choice for the presidential race and for the Democratic primary. But it's those one-on-one conversations that are really making impact and really showing some headway. The other thing that we're doing is we're not depending on people who have actually voted in previous elections. We're talking to a lot of people who have never been involved in politics before because those are essentially the core people who we're seeing come out. And it's been invigorating and exciting to see people get engaged for the first time in their lives.
Are you finding any difficulty or challenge in that Hillary Clinton kind of has the home court advantage, having lived here for decades and having so many connections in Arkansas?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that the people that are very energized around this election for us are people who really don't have any reference to the Clintons. They know them on name, like they know, they understand that Clintons have been here for a long time, but they really have no references to what they've done for them and what, how they've affected their lives. And so when we start talking about the facts and we start talking about the issues and the core values that are centered to this campaign, then those are the things that are engaging people. So we're not at all threatened or stymied by the idea that, that she may have home court advantage.
Any particular events coming up? Do you know yet? Is Senator Sanders going to be making an appearance in Arkansas?
That is the number one question I get on a daily basis. And I will tell you what I've been saying all along, is that I am hopeful that we will see the senator in state, and I can guarantee that once he does, you will be on the list of people who find out first.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that our volunteers know how to count, and we can definitely tell when we're filling stadiums. That's for sure. We've seen it all across the country.
And that's Sarah Scanlon from the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders about their approach here in Arkansas. Well, two other items were also voted on, equally important for their local areas. Sarah, voters in the what will become the Jacksonville-North Pulaski School District area voted to approve a 7.6 mil property tax increase in a special election. What will that be going for?
Well, that's going to build a new high school and renovate some existing schools in the district. The district's under a desegregation order and has to improve its facilities in order to get out of that. So the new school board made the case that it wasn't really an option to not pass the millage, although, of course, Pulaski County made a similar case last year and wasn't able to in their district. So it did pass.
And also the Little Rock voters voted overwhelmingly, a hefty majority in that election, 84%, to approve allocating bonds to fund improvements to the Arkansas Arts Center, MacArthur Park, and Military Museum. Chris, Jacob, any surprise there?
Well, you note that it was a hefty majority, but the turnout was actually quite low. It was about 6% of registered voters in Little Rock turned out for that. Most of the precincts with the most turnout tended to be the wealthier ones.
And the criticism of holding special elections from the few opponents that there were a lot of times is just, and some of the supporters of this, I imagine, is just that special elections, some people believe, are designed to have low turnout so that only supporters will show up. I think I've heard someone like David Ray from Americans for Prosperity say something recently about, I wonder how much the city of Little Rock spent on this election just, you know, 20 days before we're going to hold a primary where all this equipment would be set up anyway.
But they did, the committee that was formed to promote this this bond issue did kind of a pretty extensive campaign as far as delivering mailers and
yeah, they definitely wanted people to be aware of this.
Yeah, so there was a publicity effort, but
I looked a little bit about the precincts and how people voted in this, even though the turnout was low. People who lived in downtown neighborhoods near MacArthur Park, near the Arts Center, really for this. Those are some of the districts where it's over 90% for. I think there are only three or four districts where the margin was within single digits.
Well, Jacob, this week we're expecting to learn some specifics about the governor's proposal for Medicaid. He has talked about changing it, going from what has been the private option to Arkansas Works. He had a meeting earlier in the month with federal officials in Washington. Legislative leaders went with him, and we're expecting, is it Wednesday?
I believe so, February 17th. I think that's Wednesday.
Yeah, when he'll be going before a legislative committee and share a whole lot more about what was discussed in Washington and what we're expecting. But You also got a little bit of a hint more of what happened in that meeting and what is expected.
Yeah, and we've had a good idea of what the governor's asking for. He's made no secret about some of the loose outlines, at least, of his proposals to change the private option, to further restrict coverage, in part to appease conservatives, in part because he thinks it makes it simply a better program. But I caught up with Arkansas Surgeon General Gregory Bledsoe, who is one of the non-legislative members who went to Washington, D.C. to negotiate with federal officials for these changes of conditions of coverage for Medicaid expansion. And he wasn't scheduled to be there. I didn't know he was going to be there. I was looking forward to hearing the county judges talk about their 2017 legislative agenda. But here's Greg Bledsoe showing up by surprise. And let me play this cut first from David Hudson. He's the president of the County Judges Association of Arkansas. And he kind of explained why Medicaid expansion would be relevant at all to these county judges.
I think what we're struggling with maybe somewhat is there is the need to continue this program, and it's going to take 75% of the legislature to continue the program. And so that's probably, and I think that our senators and our representatives like to know what the county judges think if we choose to take a formal position on this matter, which is what we're trying to figure out how to address.
So the politics of this is just so close right now. Right after the primary election, within a month, they're going to have a special session just to determine the future of this program. And the governor has told county judges and others that if you don't continue Medicaid expansion, we can't have my expanded highway funding plan, and road construction is a big deal to county judges. So here's Gregory Bledsoe sort of making the governor's case. I talked to him afterward to get some better sound quality.
The numbers that I've seen show that if you have the Medicaid expansion in place, it does give us increased flexibility as a state. If you have Medicaid expansion, you're able to use your state revenue dollars in more unique ways, including applying those things to roads as opposed to putting it into the healthcare system.
And one of the county judges in the room, there's about maybe, I guess, 75, I think, or a little bit less, asked him, well, what do we tell the state legislators that are reluctant, this 25% or so that don't want to pass this? And Gregory Bledsoe, while not specifically saying he was for the governor's plan outright, he kind of made a joke and he said, I hope there's not any media in the room. And then he proceeded to tell them what to tell state legislators. I'll kind of summarize. One main point was that all the existing support structures for uncompensated care, like charity care, the state giving emergency rooms money for people without insurance, those have all been dismantled. He said, quote, to get back to where we were is not an easy fix. So that's the first argument. The second argument is that he said, even in the worst case scenario, the federal government will still pay for 90% of Medicaid expansion as opposed to the 70% we paid previously. So he's trying to make that economic argument. So that's what we know a little bit about the kind of politics going into the county judges meeting. He also, though, talked a little bit about his trip to D.C. before the governor's going to tell us what's happened next Wednesday. He explained a little bit more about this one provision. All the Republicans want people in Medicaid to work. They don't want them to be unemployed people. So the governor has said he wants to require that anyone on Medicaid get a work training referral. But we've never known, does that mean he wants people to go, that they have to complete the training? Here's Greg Bledsoe.
So the work referral is a big part of what the governor wants to do and the work referral training. The federal government has drawn a line in the sand with Medicaid that you can't require a job to get Medicaid. But the governor said, well, if we can't require a job, then we'd like to at least require a referral and some way of tracking that people are going to these referrals.
And that's part of it, seeing if people actually go.
Exactly.
Not just telling them to go, but seeing
that's
if they
right.
show up.
Don't just check a box, actually go and get the training. So that's an important aspect of what the governor wants to do. Overall, what he sees is he wants this plan to be something that doesn't become a lifestyle, but becomes a hand up. And part of that hand up is helping train people to get jobs and keep jobs and move up the economic ladder. So that's all part of that vision, yeah.
So we just don't know yet if that's all they're going to get out of D.C., not that work requirement, but sort of some sort of training. And we still don't know if D.C. will even approve that. Is that going to be enough to convince the conservative part of the governor's party?
But there has been the suggestion that HHS secretary is amenable to it, that pretty much the governor has a good idea of what is going to be acceptable and that what they can do within their options.
Yeah, I think the governor's tried to be pretty upfront and the Surgeon General with legislators and county judges, saying that a lot of the things that we really want are too outside of the box. He calls them aspirational waivers. He hopes that If Rubio or Cruz or Republican is elected president, then they can really push for some things, but they're hoping this is within the flexibility of the Obama administration, because this is all part of the Affordable Care Act.
It would seem that requiring a work referral would be an additional cost to the state and the federal government, which might
That is a concern that is not raised all that much, but it is a concern about all of these different measures designed to make people more responsible. At some level, the state bureaucracy is going to have to grow to help administer them. Who's going to make the work referrals? Who's going to do the training? And those are questions we don't really have a cost-benefit analysis that I've seen presented from the governor's office.
Well, an interesting week with the Arkansas treasurer, Dennis Milligan. He was to have a deposition on Tuesday. This was part of a defamation lawsuit filed by a former office employee against him. And from what we understand, he walked into the room where the attorney who was going to be questioning him was. The attorney apparently was using profanity. That upset Milligan because his wife was with him. And at some point, apparently there was some kind of shoving. Pretty much everyone acknowledges there was something.
Maybe a shoving that
Dennis Milligan apparently, we're told, you know, walked around to talk with this attorney. What's the attorney's
Luther
name?
Sutter.
Luther Sutter. And Milligan claims that Sutter then gave him a bit of a push. Enough of a push that he said there were chest pains that he experienced. And the next day, he came into the treasurer's office with an arm in a sling, was only there briefly before going down to the Pulaski County Prosecutor's Office to file a complaint, which is what Little Rock police had apparently advised him to do. But Milligan is seeking a charge of battery in the third degree. And this is ongoing. The prosecutor's office said they'll look into this. An attorney for Sutter says that he'll let the prosecutor's office handle their end of the process, expects parties at the highest level of state government to handle this maturely, but very odd situation.
Yeah, we still don't know, I guess. You know, the investigation is to be completed. We don't really know who shoved who. We know that Milligan didn't like that attorney used a curse word in front of his wife, because I guess he thought it offended her sensibilities somehow as his wife. But yeah, Dennis Milligan keeps popping up in the news for one reason or another in all these sort of scandalous type of controversies. And even before he was elected, of course, he was the big scandal was that he was at a Krispy Kreme donut shop trying to intimidate his primary rival, who's now the governor's budget chief, Duncan Baird, saying that he could get him a job maybe if he'd drop out of the race, allegedly. Yeah.
And he also has been facing ethics complaints. And Sarah, last week we talked about the fact that it ended up with the Arkansas Ethics Commission only deciding to press Milligan on 4 points that had been made by the attorney and liberal blogger Matt Campbell. And Campbell responded this week saying he wasn't necessarily satisfied with that.
Right. Campbell is requesting a judicial review of the Ethics Commission's decision to fine Milligan $400 for four different filing violations. They have to do with campaign finance reports about payments to volunteers and members of his family for video editing, other campaign-related, what Milligan calls minor finance issues. And his attorney, who I spoke with, Byron Freeland, says that there were no ethics violations and that the matter should be resolved because Milligan is only really paying because it's just too complicated to litigate this further.
He's trying to do two things. He represents a group of persons, one of whom has sued the treasurer, and they're trying to do everything they can to generate negative publicity about the treasurer. And second of all, he's trying to promote himself by attracting more business. In other words, he's filed this as the complaining party when he's in fact there are people he's representing, and so he's trying to, it's like advertising is what he's trying to do to build up his own business.
That was Byron Freeland, Milligan's attorney, speaking about his, thoughts on the motives of attorney and blogger Matt Campbell trying to discredit his reasons for wanting to push these ethics violations further. But Campbell says that the legislature passed a law last year that would allow, as part of an ethics reform, that would allow lawmakers to correct errors that they noticed in their finance reports, and that the Ethics Commission used that law to decide on complaints that preceded its passage so that it shouldn't apply to some of the 2014 filing violations that Campbell put forward to the commission. And he thinks that there should be about 10 violations that Milligan should be held accountable for.
I think it's pretty obvious that from the beginning it was kind of a shell game where they were just reporting things the way they wanted to and intentionally hiding payments that were going to one person by saying it went to another. And it wasn't until the complaint was filed and somebody called them on it, then all of a sudden they scrambled to fix that and to basically be able to walk away, after almost more than a year after filing some of those, to be able to then walk away and say, well, affirmative defense protected us anyway. And for somebody who campaigned on bringing integrity back to the office and transparency and obeying the law, that seems to violate all three of those tenets. So I think it's a little questionable to be trying to hide behind an affirmative defense given the totality of the circumstances.
And, of course, there he's referring to former Treasurer Martha Shaffner, who was convicted of taking bribes in office.
Right. So he's also made a complaint that's pending against both Milligan and Attorney General Leslie Rutledge for campaigning for Huckabee while they were scheduled to work. So that's another pending ethics violation. But the circuit court will review this matter, and we'll see if it fizzles out or comes up again and goes back to the Ethics Commission.
Well, this week, big news by the U.S. Supreme Court, which has opted to at least temporarily halt a new federal rule limiting carbon emissions at power plants from going into effect until all of the court challenges are heard. And Chris, you had a reaction, spoke with several people about that this week.
Yeah, well, Arkansas has been a party to this lawsuit challenging the federal Clean Power Plan, which significantly would significantly reduce carbon emissions at mainly coal-fired power plants around the country. And there are about a couple dozen states in this lawsuit. Most are from coal-producing or heavy coal-consuming states with conservative political leaders. Attorney General Leslie Rutledge praised the decision by the Supreme Court to put a temporary hold on this matter until it's fully litigated in court. She released a statement praising the decision. Of course, she believes that it was beyond the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to institute this rule. Other environmental groups like the Sierra Club said they were confident that the ruling would ultimately be upheld. But I spoke with Becky Keough, and she's the director of the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. The ADEQ and the Public Service Commission, State Public Service Commission, have been holding these regular stakeholder meetings with utilities and business interests and municipal environmental groups to kind of determine a strategy for complying with the plan if it were to be instituted. And I asked her just, whether these preparations will continue despite the court ruling, and she said they will, albeit on a modified timeline.
Well, the direction the stakeholder engagement process was taking was to begin to prepare a request to give Arkansas more time to do the planning necessary to comply with the 2018 requirements of the Clean Power Plan. That would have involved potentially a submittal for an extension in September with the stay and the fact that the courts won't fully address or resolve any outcome to the state till 2017, that deadline appears to have not be relevant anymore to the process. So I guess this is one of those issues that we need to investigate further with EPA and with our other states to determine what the appropriate action would be for Arkansas so we can make that recommendation, you know, through our legislative committees and then ultimately, you know, through a final submittal if that's required.
Now, some when this decision came down, it was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court, and a lot of legal experts around the country noted that it was kind of unprecedented because the challenge has not even been heard yet in a D.C. appeals court, and that's going to be that hearing is scheduled for June. And the phase-in period of the plan, as she kind of noted, it's a couple years out. And even Arkansas was planning to ask for an extension to for its submittal of a compliance plan. But KEO and the ADEQ have, of course, been providing materials to the AG's office and the government in the governor's office because they're, you know, they're in the middle of this challenge in the lawsuit. So they're very much aware, you know, of what the direction the state is taking in the lawsuit. So there's kind of like these two kind of competing, well, not competing, but separate narratives of the state is preparing to comply with the plan, and the state is also challenging it in court. I asked Keo, given that it seemed to be kind of a surprise to many around the country that the court made this decision, and I asked her if it was, she thought it was surprising.
From the read on the legal side, it was a unique action, I guess, or somewhat of a unique action for the Supreme Court to act at this point. With the compelling number of states that had pursued this action and the significant investments decisions that were being made by the utilities as well as other entities across the United States, the interaction that states were spending with each other and with other agencies, I believe was probably an appropriate call on the Supreme Court part, this was an unusually comprehensive and broad impact of this final rule and the timetable such that it was requiring significant decisions to be made. So the fact that a stay was engaged reflected, I believe, the overwhelming interest of the states to be able to understand the legal underpinning of the Clean Power Plan before further decisions or actions were taken.
Now, there are implications for this outside of Arkansas, of course, and even outside of our nation. The Clean Power Plan is the centerpiece of President Obama's commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement that we heard about late last year, a global agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to curb climate change around the world. Some experts have noted that, you know, other countries, especially major economies like China and India, might see this Supreme Court action to kind of undermine America's commitment to upholding their end of the Paris Climate Agreement. And so there's some concern that other countries will kind of be more reticent to uphold their side of it.
And you mentioned the hearing here in the U.S. this summer. Any indication how long it'll take to actually resolve these legal challenges?
That's really the big question right now. I mean, if the D.C. appeals court strikes it down, then the U.S. Justice Department will likely appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you know, who knows how long that will take. I'm not well versed in the timelines of federal courts to really understand.
Mm-hmm.
But the plan itself before all this was supposed to, the rule itself was finalized last summer, and the plan, states had to submit compliance strategies by this fall. They could have requested an extension. Arkansas chose to. And it wasn't supposed to really go into effect, or the major pieces of it weren't supposed to go into effect till 2018, 2020, and stuff like that.
You've been covering this issue for a while now. I'm not sure if you know about this detail of it, but This EPA rule came from the Obama administration. It's his EPA. He appoints a lot of those people, supports the clean power rule. If there's a new president in 2017 who's a Republican, could they just wipe all this out before the court even decides?
I think there's a likelihood, yeah, that a new administration, particularly one that doesn't support this or views it negatively, could revamp the bureaucracy in the EPA and do away with it. I think they have that authority.
I know the court's not saying we did this to wait and see who the next president is, though.
Probably not. No, the court order that came out, the stay or the temporary injunction or what have you, it was very, very brief, and it was only a page long. And it was interesting that it was a split decision. The five more, I guess you could argue, more conservative justices overruled the four more liberal ones in this. And so it's another example of this division on the U.S. Supreme Court that we keep hearing about.
Well, finally, Jacob, we had a plan to scale back bonus pay for Arkansas teachers that was withdrawn this week. This came amid criticism, and the governor's office backed withdrawing this for now. Explain what's happened here.
Well, this all comes in the context of there's this rift in the education community between the governor's administration, which has several times sort of loosened the qualifications and requirements for various teaching aspects. Commissioner Johnny Key, Superintendent Baker Kurris, both didn't meet traditional requirements for those professions. The governor waived them to get them in position. The governor just invested $3 million in the previous week to this decision for Teach for America, which are for people who aren't traditionally educators at least. And this whole situation is Education Commissioner Johnny Key said that fundamentally the budget doesn't exist to continue this program for teachers to become nationally board certified. And so that's kind of an elaborate process it's an achievement for teachers, and they would get a $5,000 annual bonus every year. And so the commissioner wanted to change the trajectory of the finances of this to end that bonus after a 10-year period. He said that would make the program more sustainable. So Commissioner Key, everyone expected him to show up, or he originally planned to, and make his case on why they need to scale back this teacher bonus program, but he wasn't going to do it.
I've been in conversation with the governor on the national board rules, and he has requested that the department pull those at this time. It is in the public comment phase right now.
Now, this decision from Commissioner Key did not come out of a vacuum, of course. He spoke with the governor in part because after this rule was announced, 10 out of the 15 House education members wrote a letter saying that they essentially opposed the change, that it was devaluing the profession, that the governor really should be rewarding the most qualified teachers. That's the kind of thing we should encourage. And Commissioner Key is clear that even though it's withdrawn right now, he thinks the program is not sustainable and it does need to change. The governor says he wants the status quo maintained for now, but he's not promising what that final solution would be. Is it basically just give them the additional money to keep the program as is, or are they going to, in the future, try to further scale back this bonus program? But here's Democratic Minority Leader Michael John Gray in the House. He didn't draw a line in the sand either, saying that we must fund it as is, but he came pretty close to it.
We've seen results in Oklahoma where they tweaked the stipend some. They have seen a dramatic decline in teachers that were reaching the certification. So I think sometimes we all look and go, what product is the public school turning out? What's our return on investment? Are these programs working? This is one of the programs that's working.
So this program, the reason why it's on this unsustainable path, so to speak, is that 10 years ago, there were about 500 teachers that are nationally board certified. Now there are over 2,000.
And safe to say educators happy with this for now?
They're very happy with it for now. There's both a teacher group that is unionized and non-unionized, and both of them expressed support for the caution on this from the governor's office, even though it was originally from his administration.
Well, with that, we'll wrap it up for this week, but a busy week is coming up next week, so sure we'll have a lot more to talk about on next week's podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
If you're not already a subscriber, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Thanks for listening.